District of Conservation is sponsored by the Committee for a Constructive Tomorrow, better known as CFECT. To learn more about our sponsor, head over to CFECT.org. Thanks for listening to the program.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to District of Conservation. I am your host, Gabriella Hoffman. This podcast offers a sober examination into all things hunting, fishing, shooting sports, energy, environment, and the public policy surrounding it. And this podcast also specializes in original interviews that you won't hear elsewhere. Here's what I have for you today. Today's episode is all about beanless coffee and a policy called bidet. I'm going to explain what both of these are because they may sound foreign to you, unusual, what have you, but I can assure you that they have some relation to this podcast. There's a lot of parallels between these two subjects, and I'm going to explain what that interconnectedness is. Both of these subjects, interestingly enough, want us or expect us to take additional steps to protect the environment, which would entail using more energy, perhaps destroying the environment more, all the while with the aim of going net zero or charting a carbon-free future by 2050 or some other arbitrary deadlines. That's what both of these topics ultimately desire, and you'll see that connection as I explain. One is a trend you're going to hear more of, and there are some familiar faces to beanless coffee. Bidet is a potential rule that could be finalized, although I don't think it's going to meet finalization anytime soon, but it's to update a National Wildlife Refuge policy, putting climate change above wildlife management, in essence. Again, both have the goal of fighting a so-called climate crisis, going net zero, and whether it's a trend that will probably falter because there's not enough consumer demand to abandon coffee, or this insistence on putting fighting climate change over wildlife management on a place like a National Wildlife Refuge, these are solutions in search of a problem. Here's why. Let's start with this beanless coffee story. I was reading Axios, who generally is an interesting publication, and I like reading them. I like to read sources that I may disagree with or I find to be compelling. But I saw yesterday, in honor of Earth Day, this story about beanless espresso through this Seattle-based company. I was just in Seattle, called Atomo. I'm thinking because it has a relation to molecules and atoms in the chemical reactions and processes, having studied chemistry a long time ago, but remembering what I recall. Reading from the Atomo website, they bill themselves as a coffee crafted with love for the planet and love for coffee, but without beans. And they bill themselves as the most sustainable coffee on the planet, even though they don't use beans. So coffee without beans, can you really call it coffee? That's a question. They claim that they upcycle our main ingredient by rescuing date pits from farmers' waste streams. Giving food waste a second life enables us to preserve precious environmental resources. By using farm-grown, upcycled, and superfood ingredients, we have created a lower-impact coffee option and are building a more resilient circular food system. What do those ingredients look like? According to Axios, there are a multitude of ingredients to this alternative coffee, which is beanless, mind you. And they say their goal also is to combat deforestation. More on that shortly. But what are these so-called ingredients? Are they actually good for you? Are you going to be using less energy? That's a question a lot of people are going to be asking. So Axios reports that this Seattle-based coffee company uses millet, guava, fructose, date seeds, ramon seeds, pea protein, baking soda, sunflower seeds, lemon, and fenugreek to get a coffee-like flavor. And they claim, as the company alluded to in their mission statement, they're going to be reducing plant waste. If some of these aforementioned ingredients, like pea protein, sound familiar to you, it's because they are. The aforementioned pea protein is the same ingredient used by Beyond Meat fake meat burgers. And I can't believe I even have to qualify and caveat that, because those are obviously not meat products. But funny enough, there is a connection to Beyond Meat and this new Beyond Coffee, beanless coffee option. According to Reuters, Atomo has the same investors as Beyond Meat. According to Reuters, From October 2023, a Seattle-based startup backed by some of the investors behind Beyond Meat is launching the world's first beanless coffee this week as it bids to slash the environmental impact of the popular brew. The innovation has caught the eye of investors who have poured nearly $52 million into Atomo Coffee in the hope that its brew, which uses superfoods and upcycled ingredients to mimic the molecular structure of coffee, that's where Atomo comes from. Clever name, I will give them that, but that's where it derives from, will be a hit with consumers. And they say that as the world's climate heats up, coffee farms, specifically those growing more delicate Arabica variety, favored by baristas, are moving uphill, destroying forests along the way in the search for cooler climes. But interestingly enough, Atomo Foods also again agrees with this net zero goal. Seattle-based, this is from Food Dive. Seattle-based Atomo Coffee is angling to make coffee sustainable and to thwart the 2050 problem of the global coffee supplies deteriorating with its beanless coffee. The coffee's brand is produced through reverse engineering using upcycled ingredients which contain the same molecular structure of coffee to craft a coffee-like beverage. Its newly released beanless espresso consists of those aforementioned ingredients. They tout that their carbon footprint is low. As a key selling point, it claims its product causes 93% less in emissions and uses 94% less water than traditional coffee. There's definitely room to debate over the footprint of coffee and how it's produced. And I find those statistics about coffee being, I think, the second emitter of carbon emissions in terms of land practices, I think, after farming, to be questionable and suspect. It's okay to be naturally apprehensive about this because they say that these industries are despoiling the environment. And certainly those who use child and slave labor, highly questionable. I wouldn't want to buy coffee from people exploiting child and slave labor. And hopefully the coffee that we're drinking in this country is not sourced like that. That's my hope. But now, because of criticism with certain practices, I think companies are a lot more conscious now about the, but let's go to this deforestation component, because we keep hearing that deforestation is such a pervasive problem. It hasn't improved. Forests are dying. And I want to point you to an article I alluded to yesterday in our Earth Day episode from Vox. And then I'm going to share some interesting findings from a very unlikely source, the United Nations FAO, which talks about deforestation, and they make a stunning concession about deforestation, especially in the United States. You're going to be very shocked to hear this. So to this Vox article, the title is "The Earth is Getting Greener. Hooray." It sounds like this writer is upset. But the tagline is, "Humans are literally changing the color of the planet. Scientists are worried." So the Earth getting greener is now a problem. From the same people who tell us carbon dioxide is toxic and poisonous, even though carbon is an essential element of life, especially for trees. It's not rocket science to understand that, but this is the reality. But the Vox article says, maybe you've heard our planet is not doing so great. Tropical forests are getting cut down. Parking lots are being replaced by grilled grasslands. Climate change is fueling forests raising wildfires. And on a whole, natural filled habitats seem to be disappearing. Despite this destruction, scientists keep coming to an odd conclusion. The Earth is growing greener. Not green in the metaphorical sustainable sense, but in the literal color green. In the last four decades, the extent of green vegetation, the amount of leaves in a given area, has substantially increased across the planet according to a number of recent scientific studies based on satellite data, that pesky satellite data. There is actually more green space today, not less, and this quote-unquote global greening phenomenon is not just occurring on land. Large parts of the ocean are getting greener too, research shows. Our blue planet, it seems, is increasingly a green planet. Shocker. Even with increased GDP and economic productivity. Imagine that. Understanding Earth's color is key to understanding Earth and our future on it. Greenness often corresponds to the planet's ability to absorb carbon dioxide, the primary greenhouse gas that drives climate change. The more leaves, the more photosynthesis, a chemical reaction that gobbles up CO2. That's the good news in global greening. It's helping offset some of the impacts of climate change. Back to this question about deforestation and my alluding to the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, their FAO, and a recent report within the last few years, both their 2020 and their 2022 Global Forest Resources Assessment reports have found that actually deforestation is declining, especially here in North America and our country, the United States. And a source that I'm reading called Two Sides Ende, which explains this data extrapolated from our USDA Forest Service and also Natural Resources Canada,
They say that since 1990, there has been a net loss of 440 million acres across the globe, an area larger than the entire state of Alaska. And they specifically, they mentioned that FAO specifically excludes from its definition areas where trees have been removed by harvesting or logging because the forest is expected to regenerate naturally or with the aid of sustainable forestry practices. And they say, in contrast, despite deforestation by urban development, fire, insects, and other causes, total forest area in the United States has actually increased, and forest area in Canada has remained stable since 1990. This is due in great part to sustainable forest management practices implemented by North American paper and forest products industries, the highest percentage of certified forests, nearly 50% in the world, and laws and regulations aimed at protecting forest resources. And they extrapolate the data and from the FAO, and they say, as it relates to the United States and Canada data, according to the 2020 FRA, the United States and Canada account for 8 and 9% respectively of the world's total forest areas. In the U.S., total forest area increased by 18 million acres between 1990 and 2020, which averages out to be the equivalent around 1,200 NFL football fields every day. Canada's total forest area has remained relatively stable over a 30-year assessment period at approximately 856 million acres. Approximately 59% of forest lands in North America has had long-term forest management plans. So it's because of active forest management, when you don't have government red tape intervening, that you see this regeneration of forests to combat widespread deforestation. Imagine that. So we don't have to give up coffee. We just have to do more forest management. That's what it seems like to me. And if you want to go crazy with this UN FAO, I've read this before, but I wanted to give you guys a good concrete explanation of this, and then you can read the sources for yourself. But I've seen this data before, and I was looking for it, and I was like, I know the UN had talked about this. So now you've heard it straight from the horse's mouth. Even the UN, which pushes all this net zero gunk, says that and admits through using data extrapolated from our government agencies and just observations and other data points that deforestation is on the decline. So we don't have to give up coffee to protect the forest. If you want to do that, by all means, it's your choice. You have the free will to do that. You could support whatever causes. But to me, as a conservationist, I don't feel like I have to sacrifice my coffee drinking habits for some virtue signaling like this. And I think a lot of you listening would probably agree. And also, you know, again, the questionable ingredients, like, ugh, no. And how much energy is going to be exhausted to harness these plant waste ingredients? A lot more energy. And then what was funny to me when reading about this in Axios and other sources, they are going to require a 33,000 square foot facility to conduct this and make this coffee product. So if you're talking about being environmentally conscious, why do you need a big facility? This is the same with Beyond Meat factories or whatever facilities they're building. They're going to be destroying good ag land, or they're going to be taking up a lot of space despite claiming that they're trying to be net zero, not carbon intensive, what have you. So across the chain of their command, they're not environmentally friendly. They're going to have to exhaust more energy to harness these so-called ingredients. They're going to use more land than, let's say, a conventional coffee processor, perhaps. And then they're going to tell us this is to help meet the net zero goals and to fight climate change and what have you. So a lot of questions into this. If you want to go for this, by all means, try beanless coffee. But I don't think the wider public is going to trade their coffee, Arabica beans coffee, or whatever coffee blend they like, for this kind of virtue signaling coffee. I just don't see that. And you're going to see in a few years' time, much like with Beyond Meat and all these other fake meat derivatives, they're not profitable and they ultimately have to declare bankruptcy, or they lose favor with the public, or people don't buy their products, simply put. Not to mention, how much is this going to cost? According to one estimate I was able to Google, so Otomo at a wholesale price is going to sell their coffee for $20.99 per pound, versus the 10 to 14 paid per pound by the average coffee shop. So this is going to make coffee consumption more expensive. They're going to pass this on to consumers by charging higher rates. And then you're going to have to wonder, are you actually drinking something healthy, or that is coffee? Like, why would you go through so many steps and pay more to have coffee when you can just drink the conventional drink and not have to worry about that, knowing that deforestation is on the decline because of better forest management practices? So beanless coffee, I'm not going to partake. If you want to, by all means, it's America, free choice, free will. This falls flat to me, and I don't see people ditching coffee, much like they won't ditch red meat or their gas-powered cars. Let's talk about this BDEB policy. What am I talking about? What does this acronym stand for? And it's not the toilet bidet that you often hear, the French toilet, sophisticated toilet. This is actually an acronym for something to me that is a very concerning policy. I wrote about this for Town Hall, and I spoke to Mark Oliva from the National Shooting Sports Foundation about this. And I'll explain what this is because I was able to lay it out very concretely, because they purposely put out these proposed rules, make it very hard to understand and extrapolate. But I did the dirty work for you, and I researched into it, and I have an analysis for you to deliver here on the podcast today on this episode. So what is bidet? What is this policy that they want to do at the Fish and Wildlife Service as it relates to national wildlife refuges? The title of my column is Wildlife Agency Strays from Conservation with Climate-Centric Refuge Rule. So I alluded to this being a change in policy as to how national wildlife refuges will be managed. Instead of wildlife management and other practices, climate change is going to be the focus. And we've seen this increasingly across this net zero, climate-centric focus across Department of Energy, EPA, Department of Interior. And this has rightfully upset true conservationists who feel totally sidelined and see that access to hunting and fishing grounds, or seeing these conditions of land openings to new hunting and fishing opportunities caveated by prohibitions and barriers to access, like lead prohibitions. Now you understand where this is deriving from, because they're putting, the Biden administration is putting climate above management or true conservation. And I write at Town Hall that conservationists like you who listen, or those who listen to the show, should be extremely concerned about the Fish and Wildlife Service's proposed climate-centric biological integrity, diversity, and environmental health rule update, BIDEH. That is what this acronym stands for. If you don't know, there's already existing BIDEH policy that governs the National Wildlife Refuge System, and they want to update and tweak the rule to have it prioritize focus, and chiefly focus, rather, on combating climate change to ensure biological integrity, diversity, and environmental health. And I'm going to read from the Federal Register for you. This is a little long-winded, but bear with me because I did the research and found the important parts that you need to understand from this. Quote, these proposed regulatory and policy revisions would support conservation throughout the refuge system in response to both longstanding and contemporary conservation challenges, including the universal and profound effects of climate change on refuge species and ecosystems. Together, these proposals would uphold BIDEH across the refuge system by providing refuge managers with a consistent approach for evaluating and implementing management access to protect vulnerable species, restore and connect habitats, promote natural processes, sustain vital ecological functions, increase resilience, and adapt to climate change. The rule continues in terms of what is being proposed. The service did not anticipate the extent of climate change impacts on refuge species and habitats, or the need to clarify in regulations our interpretation and authority to implement BIDEH mandate. However, in the nearly 25 years since enactment of the Improvement Act, refuges have begun to experience the effects of climate change while continuing to contend with the myriad of other anthropogenic stressors affecting fish, wildlife, plants, and their habitats. Climate change is transforming historical species composition and ecological function of habitats, creating new challenges to traditional wildlife management strategies that were based on stable, stationary baseline conditions. As the refuge system becomes increasingly vital to addressing the dual threats of biodiversity loss and climate change, the service recognizes the need to codify both existing and new practices for maintaining BIDEH to assist wildlife refuges in responding to these contemporary conservation challenges. Now, some context about the refuge system. There are over 500 refuge sites across 850 million acres, and the Improvement Act they alluded to was passed in 1997, states that refuge system was, quote, created to conserve fish, wildlife, plants, and their habitats under a true conservation mission by, quote, providing Americans opportunities to participate in compatible wildlife-dependent recreation, including fishing and hunting, on system lands, and to better appreciate the value of and need for fish and wildlife conservation. This is my commentary. Since 2001, BIDEH policy has prioritized wildlife on the refuge system, but these new practices that are being proposed for maintaining BIDEH on wildlife refuges would discourage activities which they view as anthropogenic stressors, including predator control or hunting and agricultural practices. They, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, say that these activities can perpetuate or bring about anthropogenic stressors, or are, rather, anthropogenic stressors. So this was proposed in February of this year. The comment period will close on May 6th, and there was a subcommittee hearing in the Natural Resources Committee on Water, Wildlife, and Fisheries oversight hearing to kind of expose and analyze this controversial rule and its expected negative effects on refuge management. So committee chair Cliff Bentz, a representative from Oregon, called this rule misguided and said it would not only hinder proven effective management tools crucial for well-being of our wildlife and refuge system, but also inappropriately restrict sportsmen and sportswomen who contribute significantly to conservation efforts. Regulations such as this must serve the best interests of our wildlife and those who assist their stewardship, and this rule does neither. The subcommittee also warned that the BDEA rule would block refuge managers from carrying out science-based management decisions and force them to deal with unnecessary red tape. Mark Oliva from the NSSF said to me in this article, the proposed BDEA rule doesn't follow site-specific scientific evidence to support best wildlife management practices. This would change the purpose of the National Wildlife System refuge system from conserving fish, wildlife, and plants to a system that's focused on climate change. He's absolutely correct. He continues, that is a violation of the 1997 Organic Act, which directs a strong and singular wildlife conservation mission for the refuge system. He added, the proposed BDEA rule would sideline fish and wildlife biologists to centralize authorities with Washington, D.C. bureaucrats over the on-the-ground managers who are in the best position to make these conservation decisions. If formalized, the rule would be detrimental to conserving habitat for game species and other native wildlife. This draft rule was developed without input, either informal or formal, from the sportsmen and sportswomen community who have a long-standing partnership in crafting sound wildlife management practices. If promulgated in its current form, this would have devastating negative consequences for sportswomen and men. Now, I've talked about the attacks on wildlife refuges, specifically access. So the lead prohibitions, we've talked about this to great length. Some of you may not like lead usage, but lead is a very common product for tackle and ammunition across most hunting and fishing, with the exception of duck hunting. They've moved away from lead because there was some effects there, and perhaps it's justified for waterfowl. We don't contest that. But for other forms of hunting, there hasn't really been evidence to show in fishing that lead usage, lead fragment usage, mind you, this is not pure lead. Lead fragment usage does not have a detrimental effect on wildlife writ large so far. The preservationists argue that it does, but they conflate pure lead with lead fragments. And I have gone into detail. I can cite the articles again if you need to. But if you were to remove lead, it sounds really insignificant, but you were to remove this. Okay, so you remove it. Great. Does this price people out of the activities? Does it make hunting and fishing more expensive? It will ultimately add up when you think about it. California did this, and there have been a lot of negative effects of this. It depletes the jobs that are supplied by lead tackle and ammunition as part of the greater outdoor or hunting and fishing industry. Making these activities more cost prohibitive gradually would deter people from wanting to go fishing and hunting. And then you see at the Fish and Wildlife Service, of course, in addition to these conditions of lead prohibitions on future new openings, you see them engaging in eco-grief counseling sessions. I am so disappointed in the direction. I knew this would happen, knowing who would be stacked into these agencies, who's overseeing them. Seeing this Fish and Wildlife Service stray from their mission, and then they tout, oh, we love these sportsmen contributions. Look at all this money coming in from sportsmen. And yet they're single-handedly driving policy, which is going to lead to a diminishment of that. And actually, if you notice, between 2022 and 2023, why is there a $300 billion depreciation in conservation funding? I want to know, and I need to extrapolate this a bit more. Why did we see a decrease in funding across this last year from Pittman, Robertson, and Dingell Johnson? Is this because certain prohibitions at the state level have been happening, or certain regulations have had an effect? I'm very curious about this, and I need to do my due diligence to see if there is a connection between some of these policies, top-down policies, or if certain states banning certain forms of hunting have led to this decrease in funding, or are people, sportsmen and women, just checking out of hunting and fishing altogether? We know that there's a decrease that's been happening that predates the Biden administration, but I want to know what explains this diminishment in funding by $300 million. Is it because of top-down policies? Is it because of states enacting different prohibitions on hunting? We see Colorado, Washington State, all that. But I am increasingly disappointed in the Fish and Wildlife Service's direction. I wish someone like Aurelia Skip with Giacometto, someone like that, should be in charge of the agency again. And it's so disappointing that all her great work and that of her employees and colleagues has been undone. And now you're seeing this mission statement to put climate change above all else. And then you see wildlife management suffer. You see true conservation suffer. It's embarrassing. It's also dangerous. And I hope there is a course correction, because across our areas. You may not follow this closely, but I've become increasingly cynical about the direction of conservation policy at the federal level because of people who are creating and inventing these rules to the detriment of true conservation. And then they are gaslighting us and telling us this is conservation, you have to accept it. And the people who oppose this, they're anti-conservationists. This is not conservation. This is removing managers from the landscape and telling us this is conservation. This is rewilding. This is radical preservation. This is not conservation. And I hope more people besides me stand up and point this out, because it's increasingly frustrating that I have to tell and relay this to you all, dear listeners, about this bad policy, but I have to keep you informed simultaneously, of course. But this is not conservation. And anyone telling you this is delusional. Simply put, beanless coffee and bidet. That's a mouthful for this episode. I appreciate you listening. And let me know your feedback to these two topics. Thanks for listening to District of Conservation. If you enjoyed what you heard today, go leave us some reviews on Apple and Spotify or wherever podcasts are played. Your feedback will help us reach more people, and I love to know what is on your mind after each episode. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter to never miss a beat or a guest announcement, because that is our way of updating all of you listeners. And we have just hit 1,000 followers on Instagram for the podcast account. Thank you very much. And if you have any guest suggestions or topics you want to hear on the show, I'm all ears. I would love to hear your feedback there. Thanks for listening, and stay tuned for the next episode.